All right, so Genesis 25 begins with Abraham's passing away. So kind of a bummer way to start a chapter, since we've been talking about this dude for a while. But yeah, he passes away, he dies at a good old age, that's what it says. And he, you see that he has made a couple mistakes. It says that he had some kids with some concubines. You guys know what concubines are, right? Sex slaves, not good, but he did. And he sends those kids away so that they don't mess with Isaac, and then he sets Isaac up to take over the land, which is what God intended for him all the while. Then when you move down, you get the genealogy of Ishmael, who's Abraham's other son. And it says that he ends up living in a land that's in between Egypt and kind of more Assyria kind of area. Those of you guys who are into geography, where's that? It's like Saudi Arabia, right? You guys know that, right? Ishmael's kids, they end up becoming the descendants of what we call the Arabians, right? The Arabs, as we call them today. Now, a lot of Christians have looked at Ishmael. I just want to say this really quickly. This is important because you know what the number two world religion is right now? You guys know? It's Islam. There's over a billion people worldwide. It's pretty crazy, right? It is the number two religion worldwide. You are very likely to run into a Muslim if you're walking around. And Tucson, by the way, has a lot of Muslims. You guys know why? Tucson and Phoenix are hubs for refugees. You guys know that? So in Middle Eastern countries, they're war-torn, and there's refugees, people without homes anymore. They ship them here. You know why? Because we look like their hometown. No, I'm just kidding. it's because nobody cares about Tucson. They're like, oh, well, we're not going to put them in L.A., you know? Like, that's a lot of, we're just going to ship them here. So actually, there's quite a bit of refugees from Africa and Arabian countries. So we have quite a big Muslim population. And you guys might be like, well, where is this? It's all downtown. They ship them downtown. So that's why you see all the mosques coming up downtown in that area. That's why. We have huge influx of Muslim population nowadays. That's why we have ministries in Tucson called the Tucson Refugee Ministry. It's a great ministry. Helps out those people. Because what happens is when those people come in, the mosques, they set aside money to help them out. And so they get them inducted in. What Christians are starting to do is they're starting ministries where we can help them out as well, so that hopefully we can share the gospel with them. So really, really cool stuff. So it's kind of important that we actually learn about Ishmael's genealogy, because the Bible never says that Ishmael was rejected. In fact, God made a covenant with Ishmael, right? It's different than the covenant he made with Isaac, but he made a covenant with Ishmael and his descendants. And believe it or not, Ishmael's descendants are mentioned quite a few times in the prophetic books. And one of the signs of Jesus' return, believe it or not, is Ishmael's descendants coming to know him. Do you guys know that? It's in quite a few prophetic books. And so when we're wondering, like, are we in the time when Jesus is coming back? Well, what should we be seeing? We should be seeing a lot of Muslims giving their lives to Jesus. You know, if you study history and everything that's going on, Muslims are coming to Christ in numbers that were unheard of just not too long ago, right? Because no matter what side you are on the war, obviously I fought in the war, and I'm not too excited about it, but, you know, no matter what side you fall on the war, one thing I have to admit is that because of what has happened, we have loosened the grip of extremist Islamic influence on that side of the world. And now for the first time, missionaries are able to go to places like Afghanistan. They're persecuted, but they're there. You know, and the gospel is being shared. And it's crazy. We have stories of, you know, sheikhs and imams, you know, Muslim leaders having dreams and visions of Jesus. It's a really cool time. So we as Christians, when we read about Ishmael, when we read about the Arabian people, we shouldn't be like, oh, those dirty Muslims, you know, and their horrible 9/11 schemes and whatever. And that's why, you know, God, and he's the son of, you know, Hagar and Abraham. And that was Abraham's greatest mistake. And God's punishing all of us because of it. You shouldn't think that way. You know, because God made a covenant with Ishmael. He loves Ishmael. He cares about Ishmael and his descendants. And that's one of the, like I said, it's one of the signs of Jesus' return, is those people coming back to him. So we should share with them, and we should hang out with them. And I tell you guys this before, but I hang out with this dude named Ahmed. He's an imam at the mosque on the U of A campus. I hang out with him almost once a week, and we talk about stuff. And our conversations get really heated. You know, because you talk to people from the Middle East, they get very into stuff. You know, and he's from Pakistan, And, you know, we're in a coffee shop, we're all yelling at each other, and everyone's like, whoa, you know, but then, you know, at the end, we're like, dude, I love you, you know, we walk away, and it's awesome, man, it's really cool that I get to have those conversations with them. But anyway, it's kind of a sidetrack, but I just want to share that with you guys. The thing that I really wanted to focus on today is we're going to be focusing on a messed up family situation. You know, we're going to be focusing on Isaac, his wife Rebecca, and their two kids, Esau and Jacob, and kind of the messed up family dynamic that is. And it's really important to understand this, because a lot of Christians, you guys may have heard this at some point, they'll be like, you know, you guys need to wait till you're married, because if you don't, God won't bless your marriage. And the insinuation there is that if you do things right, your marriage will be perfect. You know, you'll get married, no struggles. Well, guess what? Isaac and Rebecca did everything right, and their marriage has some problems. Has some pretty serious problems. Now, granted, they're not dealing with the sexual mess that was Abraham's relationship with his wife. That was far worse. But they still have problems. No matter what we do, no matter how we follow God, you're going to have struggles, you're going to have trials. The unfortunate thing that's happening in the American church today is we're trying to teach you guys how to get out of suffering, when that is not the biblical way at all. What the Bible says is that you will suffer. The important thing is, what are you going to do when you suffer? How are you going to deal with your suffering? How are you going to move closer to God in spite of the fact you're suffering? And another question to ask is, why am I suffering? Okay, so let's focus. It begins with Isaac. So let's go to verse 21. Now Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord granted his plea. And Rebekah, his wife, conceived. Now, this is the same thing that happened to Sarah and Abraham. You guys remember, right? Sarah was not able to have children. And we talked about this when we were talking about Sarah. In that culture, the number one thing that a woman could do is provide offspring. And so for a woman to not be able to have kids was one of the worst things that could happen to her. In fact, in a couple chapters, we'll talk about next service, you guys won't be here, but another couple chapters, Jacob's wife has some problems having kids. And she looks at her husband, she goes, give me children or else I'm going to die. And you're like, that's pretty insane, you know. It's pretty intense that someone would say that, but that's the way they felt in that culture. If you can't have kids, you're basically a dead person. You know, you're no use to anybody. And so she's struggling with this. And the first question right off the bat is like, you know, why is Isaac and Rebecca struggling this way? I thought aren't they doing things right? You know, why would God punish them in this way? You know? And we have to remember what Abraham learned through Sarah being barren, from her not being able to have kids, is they learned how to rely on God. They learned how to depend on God and to trust Him. If God didn't put you and me in situations where we had to trust Him, guess what we would do? We would never trust Him. Let's face it, we grew up, we're Americans. We think that everything we have in our life is earned, even though it's total crap. You know, it's like none of it's true. But we like to believe that, though, right? You know, I worked hard in school. I did this, I did that. And that is why I am sitting before you guys with my career and everything that's happening in my life, because I earned it, you know, and that's the way we like to believe. The Bible throws monkey wrenches into that. It says, no, you're the way that you are because God has blessed you with the life that He's given you. And you need to learn how to give thanks. And the unfortunate truth is, unless God puts us in situations like this, you won't learn. You just won't. So Isaac has to learn the same lessons of his dad. He has to learn how to trust God. And this is something that's important. Isaac's life would certainly have been easier if he didn't have to go through this. But it wouldn't have been better. Learning to trust in God is a far greater gift than simply having a good life. You guys understand that? Learning to trust in God is such a great gift that it far exceeds just having a perfect life with no struggles. And even from a worldly perspective, we get this. I don't know if any of you guys have run into people, you know, maybe kids your age, who have had relatively blessed lives. You know, they've grown up. And what do we call that? When someone has a life with no struggles or heartaches. We call them spoiled, right? We call them spoiled. The reason why is because when someone grows up like that, where their parents just cater to their every whim and they never have to go through anything, they tend to grow up pretty naive to the world. They tend to grow up pretty uncompassionate, right? and they tend to grow up pretty selfish. Now, we would look at that and be like, well, why? I mean, think about it. Why are they that way? It's because their parents actually took care of everything for them, right? And so it's weird that we would look at that, we would say, that's bad parenting. It's bad parenting to take care of all of your kids' problems and to try to take away suffering altogether? And we'd be like, yeah, because you're spoiling them. Why do you think it's bad parenting if God lets you go through trials? You ever thought that maybe that's what he's trying to do in your life? To not make you spoiled? But we don't tend to think of it that way. But you should. You absolutely should. In Romans 5, he says, and we glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulation produces character. And character, perseverance, and perseverance, hope. Right? So Paul understood this, and we need to understand this. God brings us through trials so that we might depend on him. Because he is the one that we need anyway, right? He is everything to us. So God's trying to teach him and his wife these lessons. But they don't really fully get it, and we'll see in a second. So what happens? I'm going to brush past a couple of these verses. She ends up getting pregnant with twins, which is every mother's dream in our culture, right? Twins, yeah! You know, I know you guys are just gunning for that. But anyway, she gets twins, and she's it's funny how she describes it. Because, you know, like I when I first read these verses a long time ago, I was like, man, what does this mean? You know, she says, like, there's a war going on in her stomach. I was like, what does that mean? And I used to think that, you know, when a woman got pregnant, she just sat there and the baby just kind of slept, like, in her stomach. And I thought that's how it went. Then my sisters got pregnant, and I realized that these kids are, like, they're, like, messing, they're, like, rolling around. They're, like, punching their stomach. They're, like, doing all these crazy stuff. Yeah, dude. It's, like, crazy. So I was like, whoa. And just to think about two babies in there, I've never known anyone who's pregnant with twins. But she's like, dude, there's, like, a war going on in my stomach. And she freaks out, and she goes to God. She's like, God, I thought that you bless us with kids, and this is what's going on. This is crazy. And God tells her, he says, hey, the reason why is because you have twins. And these two twins are not going to be the best of buddies. You know, they're going to actually be at odds with one another. And he says, the younger is actually going to dominate the older, which was unheard of in that culture. In that culture, the older always had dominion over the younger. But God says, hey, I'm gonna throw things on its head. Because this is the major, this is the, what's that? Not the babies, right? This is the major thing that we get from the book of Genesis and the other Old Testament passages. You can get a lot of good life lessons from Genesis, absolutely. But you get a good life lessons from, you know, fairy tales as well. You know, that's not the primary reason for the Old Testament. The primary reason for the Old Testament is to explain the gospel. When Jesus was on the scene, people asked him about the Old Testament. He says, you study the scriptures because in them you believe you have eternal life. These are they that testify of me. So Jesus says that every passage of the Old Testament is actually about him. And reading these passages, we'd be like, well, what about this could possibly be about Christ? The message of the gospel is very simple. God loves people in spite of the fact that they are against him. And God blesses and glorifies people by grace and not by works. You guys get that? That's the message of the gospel. God consistently throws culture on its head in the book of Genesis. Right? He takes a woman who's barren, who in that culture was the worst insult ever. It was actually, in a lot of their minds, it was proof that God hated you if you couldn't have kids. And he took a woman who's barren and he made her the mother of the blessed union, right? The mother of the chosen nation of Israel. He takes the younger and he makes him the ruler. Everything God's doing is he's actually explaining the gospel, that the gospel is going to be for people who don't deserve it, but it's going to be for people who need it. And that's what he's trying to get across to us. Now, when they're coming out, the funny thing is, back in the day, they had great names, right? When they named people back in the day, it's not like when you have a kid, you know, like right when you're in the hospital, you got to write down the name of the kid on the birth certificate, which I had a buddy that was kind of funny in that story where his parents didn't know what to name him. So they wrote on his birth certificate, not named, in the place of his first name. And they totally forgot to change it. They just called him Anthony. And they never changed his name on his birth certificate. So he legally, until he was 18, had a name of not named Anthony. And so it was pretty unfortunate for him. But, you know, but that was what it was legal for him. But anyway, that culture, that's what they would do. When you had your kid, you wouldn't name him instantly. You would actually watch him for a little bit, and you would name him after what he did. So their names actually meant something. Do you guys get that? So Isaac's name, do you remember what his name meant? laughter, right? Because both of his parents laughed when God told them that they were going to have kids. And God kind of turned it into a cool thing. You know what Rebecca's name means? I think this is hilarious. Rebecca's name means ensnarer. That's what it means. And the reason why it's the name is because when the dad would have a very cute little girl, he's like, man, she's like ensnaring me, man. She's just so cute. You know, I know she's just I'm going to give her everything because she's so cute. You know, that's what he would name her. And Rebecca ends up becoming this really beautiful girl, you know, and she ends up marrying Isaac. So that's what her name means, though, is ensnarer, someone who ensnares with their beauty. And then Esau comes out and they name him Esau. You know what Esau means? It means hairy, man. He comes out just like probably like full chest hair, you know, like probably full already hit puberty, you know, like they're just like, dude, this is hairy, you know, so they name him hairy when he's coming out. And back in that culture, you know, having hair is like, that's like a manly thing. In our culture, we're kind of going the other way, you know, hairless is the way to go. But in their culture, it was like, man, being hairy, dude, Jerry would have been like the king, man. Be like, yeah, dude, that's 70s, bro. Yeah, you know, you go out to those cultures, all the guys have beards, right? You go to the Middle East, they all have beards. They're all very hairy. That's like, that's manly. That's good. You know, being hairy in that culture was good. It was a symbol of masculinity. And so they name him Harry. They're like, dude, this dude's Harry. He's going to be a man. And they're all excited. And then out comes Jacob. And all they see out of Jacob is he's grabbing his heel. Like he's trying to drag him. He's trying to get in front of him. And they're like, dude, we're going to name him Jacob. You know what Jacob means? Literally heel catcher. That's what it means. Literally heel catcher. What's that? Now you know, man. And literally heel catcher, that word, it means somebody who will try to get one up on you. It's like a treacherous person. So it's not exactly the best name, but it's the name that they named him. And we're actually going to see how these names impact these kids, which is pretty radical. And I'll explain that how that kind of appeals to us in a second. But that's what they name him. And then in verse 27 says this. So the boys grew. Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a mild man. Some translations say complete or patient or mild man. Dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau because he ate his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. So Esau grows up and becomes a hunter. You know, he's going out. He's like the Duck Dynasty guys, and he's like slaying deer, and he's bringing them back, and he's all manly and awesome, and he's skinning them, and he's wearing fur coats or whatever. And his dad is digging it because his dad was a shepherd. So the only meat his dad was eating was goats and whatever else they had, sheep, whatever. But Esau is able to go out and get that exotic beef. You know, he's able to go out and get that venison, you know, which is good. Maybe some bear meat. You know, he's able to get like rattlesnake and he's jerky. I don't know. But he's making his dad all this good exotic food. And his dad's like, dude, Esau, man, he's my boy. You know, because the way to a man's heart is through his stomach, right? You know, so he's like, dude, Esau's my boy, man. I love that dude. You know, he goes out, he knows what his papa wants, you know, and he's all pumped. Now it says that Jacob was a mild man. It doesn't mean that Jacob was a sissy. You know, a lot of people have kind of made it out that Jacob's like kind of a mama's boy, and he's hanging out at home, and he's like, you know, making food, and he's like, yeah, he's wearing an apron, says kiss the cook, and he's got like my little first oven, and he's like hanging out, and he's making brownies. You know, we have this idea of Jacob, but that's actually not true. As we read the story, we'll see that Jacob was actually a pretty manly guy. He just wasn't a hunter. He was like his old man. He would hang out with his mom. He did know how to cook, but so did Esau. Esau cooks later too. But he was a shepherd. He hung out with the animals. So don't get the idea from that verse that Jacob's at home watching Netflix. You know, he's like, whatever. Esau's out hunting. I don't care. You know, he's like, dude, that he's working. He's just doing a different kind of work. And so because of that, Rebekah actually ends up loving Jacob a little bit more. And here you see the first cracks in the family. You guys see this? Where you have favoritism. You have favoritism. And you see that not only is this favoritism impacting the kids, we'll see how it's impacting the kids in a second, but it's actually impacting the parents. Because in Rebecca's mind, she's able to justify her favoritism by saying, well, God said that the younger is going to rule over the older, so I'm just following God. And Isaac could justify it and be like, well, Esau's the firstborn, so I'm just, you know, hanging out with the firstborn. There's nothing wrong with that. And they're both like justifying their sin and not realizing that they're sinning. The Bible talks a lot about love. And it talks a lot about love. And this is something that's really important to understand about love. It is not love to care for one person at the expense of another. In our culture, we don't tend to make that distinction. Right? In our culture, it's like, man, it's me and my wife against the world. You know, no matter who I offend, dude, we need to be together. It doesn't matter about any of you guys, you know, because it's about me and my wife. You know, she comes first. And in a way, that's true. But if my love for my wife comes at the expense of everybody else, is that really love? And the Bible would say no. Right? Is it wrong for Isaac to love Esau? No. Is it wrong for Isaac to favor Esau at the expense of Jacob? Yes. Do you guys understand that? See, when you're thinking about love, unfortunately, like I said, we're just too simplistic as Americans. And we think of love like, you know, a game of checkers. You know, love is like chess, man. You need to think about not just the piece that you're moving, but you need to think about all the other pieces that are impacted and influenced by what you're doing. You guys understand that? You gotta think a little bit more clearly. In Romans 14, he's talking about meat sacrificed to idols, and some of the Christians are like, dude, idols are nothing. Who cares if someone sacrifices meat to an idol? I like my beef. I'm going to eat it. I don't care, man. I get it at a discount at the temple. I'm going to go. I'm going to eat it. Screw everybody else. And some of the Christians came out of an idolatrous background, and they're like, dude, that kind of stumbles me. Yeah, I used to worship that God, and that stumbles me to see Jerry over at Aphrodite's temple eating up that venison every day. You know, that's kind of a stumbling thing. I don't like it. And Jerry's like, dude, who cares, man? You know, my family loves meat, and I'm going to buy meat for them. So screw you, you know? And so, you know, but in Jerry's mind, he's like, dude, I'm loving my family. Do you guys get that? I'm loving my family. And in the other person's mind, they're like, no, I'm loving my family by trying to protect them from that kind of garbage. And Paul writes in Romans 14, he says, if what you eat stumbles the person for whom Christ died for, you have abandoned love. You guys get that? So is Jerry loving his family? Yeah. But is he loving other people? No. So love at the expense of other people is not love. Now, there are some exceptions to that. You guys probably understand, right? If, let's say my wife, let's say her family were non-believers, and they hate the fact that I'm a Christian. They hate the fact that I'm, this is not true, by the way, but, you know, let's say they're non-believers, and they hate the fact that I'm a Christian, I'm a minister, and I want to marry Emma, and they're just like, no. Should I at that point be like, well, in the name of love, you know, I need to allow them to speak and be okay with that. Is that what the Bible's getting at? No. It says this, as long as it is up to you, live at peace with all men. You guys get that? So as long as it's up to me, I need to live at peace with all men. But if people won't be at peace with me, I need to do everything I can on my end. But at the end of the day, it's their decision. Right? So parents are kind of messing up in this way and with their names. Now, let's see how this is impacting their relationship. Verse 29. Now, Jacob cooked a stew. So he's making some stew. He's making some lentil soup, you know, some beans, whatever. It's good stuff. I don't know if you guys have ever had, like, Middle Eastern kind of cooking, but it's good, man. It satisfies the soul for sure. Esau came in from the field and he was weary. And this story doesn't tell their age. I would like to believe that Esau is a teenager in this particular story for this next sentence. But you guys see what I mean in a second. Verse 30. Esau said to Jacob, please feed me with that red stew, for I am weary. Therefore his name was called Edom, which means red. But Jacob said, sell me your birthright as of this day. And Esau said, look, I'm about to die. So what is this birthright to me? You know, so Esau's getting a little low blood sugar. You know, he's a little hypoglycemic. He's missed a meal. He's a little tired. That's what I said. I would like to believe he's a teenager in this story. I mean, it doesn't really say. There's no context to say that what age he is. But either he's a teenager or he's just a really burly dude. He's like, dude, I'm about to die. You know, I'm withering away. You know, what good is my birthright to me now? Now, this birthright, what it was, is it was the rights of the firstborn. So when the father died, you know, even in our culture, we have wills, right? So when my parents pass away, they have a will, and they've allotted certain amounts of money to the kids, right, to the inheritance. And or you get life insurance, which is still money. But at any rate, in their culture, the firstborn got twice as much as anybody else. And the reason was because the firstborn was then supposed to take care of the family. So they were given twice as much money, and then they became the head of the household, and they were supposed to continue the family business, as it were. And that's what it was. So that's what he's talking about, this birthright. He's like, dude, Jacob's like, give me your birthright. Now, during their growth, do you see how this is kind of developing in their lives? How this rivalry has started? Where did this rivalry come from? Came from the family, right? Rebecca was probably hanging out with Jacob and be like, dude, God said that you're going to be ruling over your brother, man. So don't worry about it. You know, so in Jacob's mind, he's justified in tricking his brother. And in Esau's mind, we'll talk about Esau in a second. But, you know, he's jacked. But we'll talk about Esau in a second here. But Jacob, in his mind, he's feeling a little bit justified. Now, the other reason why he's doing this is actually because of his name. Now, in our culture, we don't do this. Like I said, our names, I don't know. Were any of you guys named after something you did when you were born? You know, for most of us, you know, I'm named after, like, my grandpa or something. You know, like, they're just like, yeah, they're just like, hey, dude, yeah, they're just names they give it to you. That sounds cool, and they just give it to you. In their culture, that's not how it was. But when you're growing up, usually for a lot of us, our parents might give us nicknames at some point, right? And the nickname does have to do with what you do. And some of them are good nicknames. Some of them are not so good nicknames. But the thing is, when you're growing up, and someone brands you with something like this, right? If my dad, and it may have been a joke, right? It may have been a joke in their family. They're like, dude, look at that little heel catcher, you know, a little usurper, a little treacherous deceiver little guy, you know? And they're probably like joking with him. But he's growing up, he's hearing this every day, you know? My dad's calling me a deceiver every day. He's calling me a treacherous guy every day. Like, that's my name, you know? Like, every time he calls me, it's just a reminder that I'm a treacherous person, that I'm a deceiver. And after a while, people treating you a certain way, you start acting a certain way. You guys understand that? You kind of fit into the mold of how other people see you. It could even go this way in your mind. You'd be like, well, this is how everybody sees me, so it might as well be the way that I am. And even if you try to get outside of that mold, you're like, no, I'm not this way. You know, you try to go out of it. But in your heart, you'll always believe, but this is who I am. You know, I'm just a deceiver. I'm just a rotten scoundrel. And so in his mind, he's like, now he should have been like, dude, God said that I'm getting the birthright. I don't need to deceive my brother. You know, God said I'm going to get it. So who cares? But in his mind, he's like, dude, this is the only way I'm going to get it, through being a deceiver, because that's what I am. So he deceives Esau. Now let's talk about Esau, because Esau's funny to me. Esau is like the flesh, dude. He is the total fleshly nature of humankind. In the Bible, Esau becomes... he becomes an example of what not to do. Over and over again, biblical authors use Esau as like, don't be like Esau. Don't be like that guy who sold his birthright for a bowl of soup. You know, they're like, dude's an idiot. And this is what they're getting at. They're not saying that something spiritual is going on here. That Jacob represents the devil, and, you know, the birthright represents salvation, and the soup represents damnation, and, you know, they're not saying anything spiritual about this. They're just talking about what kind of person Esau was, what kind of person he was. Now, Esau, what he sees is he only sees what's right in front of him. He's not thinking about the impacts of the future. It'd be the same kind of person who, you know, I was in the Marines, and I had a lot of buddies who were kind of stupid, and they gave us tons of speeches, right? Because after our first deployment, you know, you deploy, you get, first of all, you get pay, you get combat pay, so you get extra money for getting shot at, which is cool, you know, and it's all tax-free, and you're in Afghanistan. What are you going to spend your money on? So literally, you're working 24-hour days for 7 months, you come back, you got about 15 grand in the bank account, you know, like right off the bat. You know, you just come home, you got 15 grand, which is pretty, it's a lot of money for someone my age, you know, it's a lot of money for a lot of people, but, you know, it's a ton of money for us, so we're like, dude, we're rich. We're rich, you know, and so we all think that we're wealthy and loaded, and they give us like a bunch of speeches like, don't blow your money on a nice car, you know, just think about it, you know, save it, put it in, you know, put it in the savings account, you know, don't touch it, you know, just let it grow, let it accumulate, do your thing. But everybody came home, they're like, no, I'm getting a car, you know, and they all came home and they got like nice Mustangs or like, you know, and that's their whole money. That's all their money, because a Mustang is like, you know, $45,000. So they spend all 15 grand on this thing, and then they still owe 30. And because they're idiots, they take out 20% APR, which, do you guys know what that means? Right, APR, annual percentage rate. So every year, you're paying 20% of what it's worth. On top, it's not even That's not even paying off the debt. That's just how much you're paying that car company for having the car, you know? And so they're paying like a ton of money. Off the top of your heads, was 20% of 30,000? $600, right? $6,000. So every year they're paying $6,000. That's not even paying off the debt. Do you guys get this? All right? So they're kind of stupid. They're not thinking about the whole thing. All they're thinking in their brain is, I want a Mustang. Right? They don't think about what it's going to cost them. They don't think about the consequences. They don't think about anything that's going to happen to them in the future. They're just like, dude, this is easy. I want the Mustang right now. That's all they think about. You guys could be foolish. I could be foolish in this way too. Where there's an easy way, but there's a smart way, right? Hey, you know what? For those of you guys in high school, it might be easy for you to drop out of high school. That's really easy. But is it smart? Is it going to benefit, like 20 years down the road, are you going to be like, dude, thank God I dropped out of high school. You know, man, that 2 years that I would have spent in high school would have been so much, you know, and I'm just so thankful I had those 2 years to work at McDonald's and get that awesome business sense that I needed to become the millionaire that I am today. Einstein. No, right? You know, what's that? Einstein did drop out of high school, but he went back to college. He was a patent clerk. So, you know, that's not a good example, but you know, like so. And he was a genius. But anyway, so when you think about these things, it's like there's easy way and then there's a smart way. We need to weigh options. Now, here's where the spiritual little example comes in. Okay, so this is what he's doing is not spiritual here, but there is a spiritual implication here. Sin will always be easier than doing the right thing. Sin will always be easier than doing the right thing. If you do something stupid, it's really easy to lie. That takes no effort. I don't have to teach a single... Man, if I went to the 4- and 5-year-olds class today, I don't have to teach them a class on how to lie. I don't have to be like, hey, if you guys do something stupid, this is how you lie. This is how you get away with it. I don't have to do that. That's natural. People know how to do that from birth. Okay? What I need to teach them how to do is I need to teach them how to tell the truth when it's hard. Sin will always be harder. I mean, sin will always be easier than doing the right thing. But what Christianity states is not that sin is more difficult. That's not what we're trying to say. We're saying that sin is easier short term, but it's bad for you long term. You guys get that? Is having sex before marriage easy short term? Yeah, it's easy. Anyone can do that. That's simple. That's natural. Waiting till you get married is difficult. Okay? Finding somebody, right, even dating somebody who's correct for you is difficult. Okay, it's far easier to get into a relationship with someone who doesn't believe in God. That's really easy. They're all over the place. It's easy, right? They're a little bit more forward. You go into the church, you're like, this is a weird culture. I mean, the guys are a little funky, you know. I know you ladies are like, dude, the guys are a little weird. You know, they're, I don't know. You know, I kind of like the dudes at my school. You know, you might be thinking that, and then you guys are like, man, you know the girls? They're a little quiet, you know. I think I like these loud girls over at my school. I think they want to do this, and that's the way we think in our minds because it's always easier. It's always easier to give in to sin, but is it better? And that's the question you ask yourself. It's always easier, but is it better? It's always easier to lie, but is it better to tell the truth? In my life, even in my marriage with my wife, there are so many times where it would be so easy to yell at her, but would it be good? You know, we're in a conversation, you know, we're not getting anywhere. And I'm just like, you know, I could feel the anger rising up. Man, it would be easy to just be like, why don't you get this, you know, and just yell. But is it better? Is it going to benefit the marriage? Is it going to grow us? Is it going to make us better as people, better as followers of Christ? No. Right? Is it easy to blow off church? That's easy. Is it easy to not read your Bible? Of course it's easy not to read your Bible, to not pray. It's easy. But is it better? Paul puts it this way. In 1 Corinthians 9, he says, you know what the Christian life is like? He's like, it's like training for the Olympics. Yeah, that's what he says, no joke. He's like, it's like training for the Olympics. He says, you know, these Olympians, they're all training, they're putting their bodies under subjection. What are they training for? Like a Wheaties box and maybe like a gold medal. You know, that's all they're getting out of it. And he's like, dude, do you know how much they train? Olympic athletes? They are crazy. Every day, they're working out for like 10 hours a day. And they're eating crazy amounts of food. And it's nuts the stuff that they have to do to compete at the Olympic level. They have to abstain from relationships. They have to abstain from all sorts of bad stuff for them. They're living a pretty disciplined life. And Paul says, dude, they're doing that to get a stinking... In his day, it was even less. You get a wreath. You know, it wasn't even made out of gold. You got a wreath, a little crown. And he's like, dude, they're doing this for a stinking wreath. You know, and it's going to die. And no one cares. All right? No one knows that this person's going to fade into obscurity in 4 years. No one's going to remember this person. And he's like, dude, they're training their butts off for this. And he's like, but we're going after God. Dude, and God is eternal. Dude, the love of God is going to last for all of eternity. The pleasure of God is going to just increase every day the closer we get to Him. He's like, why aren't we running like that? Why are we doing what is easy instead of what is best? That's what the Olympic athlete has to think all the time. Is it easy for me to skip working out today? Yeah. But is it going to help me win that medal? Probably not. You know, and that's what an Olympic athlete is thinking of all the time. So in our lives, I don't want you guys to be naive and to think that the Christian life is easy. It's not easy, but it is better. You guys understand that? Doing the right thing is not easy. Every one of us is going to struggle with it. I struggle with it every day, right? Whether or not to love my wife or to lust after other women. Whether or not to tell the truth or to tell lies. Whether or not to get angry at people and yell at them or to be calm with them and do the right thing. And I have to make a choice. And you know what? I fail all the time. But I need to understand this is part of the Christian walk. It's not easy, but it's worth it. That's what we're saying. It's not easy, but it's worth it. It's difficult, but it is always worth the effort. Okay? Any questions about that? No. Okay, we're going to basically skip chapter 26. It's long, and I'm just going to tell you what happens. A famine happens in the land, and Isaac goes to the land of the Philistines, which is what God tells him to do. God tells him, like, hey, chill out in the land of Philistines. It's going to be cool. So he does that. However, while he's there, he pulls an Abraham, right? That's going to be a phrase for the rest of eternity. He pulls an Abraham, and he's like, dude, these guys are going to kill me. Hey, Rebecca, pretend to be my sister. Same thing his dad did. Exact same thing his dad did with the same people in the same land, dude. And like, what happens in this story is the king sees Isaac getting a little fresh with his wife in a courtyard. And he's like, dude, either she's your wife or you got issues. You know, either she's your wife or there's something really wrong going on in your relationship with your sister. You know, like you need some help. So he's like, dude, just be honest with me. And Isaac's like, yeah, she's my wife. He's like, dude, what is wrong with you? And he just totally rebukes him. And he sends out an edict. He's like, dude, if anyone touches this guy or his wife, I'm going to hunt you down and I'm going to kill you, because this is the same dude who had Abraham and Sarah. And that whole debacle, when Abraham said the same thing about his wife, and basically when this guy took Sarah into his house, thinking that it was Abraham's sister, not his wife, God cursed them with some sort of a hardcore venereal disease. I don't know exactly what it was, but it was something so intense that no one could have kids anymore. And they're like, what has happened to us? So he's like, dude, I'm not taking any risks. If anyone touches this guy, I'm going to kill you. Like, I'm going to hunt you down. I'm going to kill you. Do not touch this guy. And so he's getting a little angry at Isaac. And you know what God does immediately after this story? Like, the next verse, it says Isaac planted, and then he reaped 100-fold of what he planted. And we read it, we're like, what the heck? You know, like, dude, he just blew it. God, where's the discipline, man? You know, shouldn't he plant and reap nothing? You know, and God's like, that's what you get for lying, you liar. You know, that could have been what he does, but he just blesses the guy. Just overabundantly. What do we see? The doctrine of grace. God blesses us in spite of who we are, never because of it. God always blesses in spite of who we are, never because of it. Do not think, never think that the people who are in authority are there because they earned it. Never think that I am a pastor because I know this stuff cold and I am just perfect and that's why I'm teaching you guys. God always blesses in spite of us, never because of us. If you could point to anything and say, like, well, the reason why God blessed me is because of this, then you are in the flesh. And you're going away from God. All right, so God will, primarily, He'll put us through situations like Isaac where you blow it, and then He'll bless you to show you that, dude, it's not because of you, it's because of me. Not because of you, it's because of me. When I got on staff on this church, I'll just tell you guys this little story. I was trying to get on staff for like a year, before I actually got on staff. And I thought, like, during that year, I was like, man, I'm on point. I'm doing everything right. Of course, I'm going to be on staff. You know, I was serving in the youth. I was doing it for free. And then all of a sudden, I got into this place where I started to have an attraction for the girl who's now my wife. And we had kind of a rough relationship. And I was kind of an idiot. And I ruined a lot of things in that relationship. And I was making tons of errors. And I was ruining a lot of stuff. And then at my lowest point, where I totally screwed up that relationship, I thought, there's no way we're ever going to be together. I've totally ruined all this stuff. At that point, Bo's like, hey, dude, you want to come on staff? I was like, what, now? Now? Like, what I'm blowing it? I was like, dude, what the heck is going on? And I remember, you know, 1 Corinthians 1, it's one of my favorite passages. I hold it pretty close to my chest. It says, not many who are wise are chosen. Not many who are mighty are chosen. But God has chosen the weak things to put to shame the things that are strong. And the foolish things to put to shame the things that are wise, so that nobody can glory in his presence. And I read that passage and I was like, ironically, what qualifies me for ministry is what a wreck I am. You guys get that? So that anyone looking at my life, and when I look at my life, I can't possibly be like, this is because I'm on point. But like, dude, this is because God loves me some crazy how. You know, that's why. Beyond that, you'll never understand God's love for you if you think that you've earned it. God's love for you is unconditional. It is in spite of the fact that we are born sinners, opposed to Him. Unless you get that, unless you wrestle with your own wretchedness, the idea that God loves you won't mean a whole lot to you. Be like, did you read the Bible? God loves you. Of course. You know, look at my life. Of course He loves me. Everybody loves me. You know, I love me, you know. Got 1,000 friends on Facebook. Of course He loves me. You know, why wouldn't He? If that's what you think, you're never going to appreciate the cross. In Luke chapter 7, Jesus is hanging out with a very sinful woman, and He's hanging out with a Pharisee. And the woman cries at His feet. She wipes His feet with her hair. Very humble what she does, right? I couldn't imagine doing that to somebody. That's gross, right? You know, even my wife. You know, I know where her feet go. You know, you know, I don't know about that. But she's like kissing His feet. She's crying on Him. She's wiping Him with her hair. Just very humble, very intimate act. And the Pharisee's sitting there just like, dude, this chick is a sinner. And Jesus looks at me and goes, you know what, man? There's a guy. He owed two people owed him money. One owed him $500. The other owed him $50,000. Forgives both of them. It's like, which one will appreciate him more? He says, well, of course, the one he forgave more. He says, that's right. The one who is forgiven much loves much, but he who's forgiven little loves little. He says, this woman, she sinned a lot, but she's like, but she is loved a lot. And he looks at her and he says, your sins are forgiven. In our lives, the level of how much you feel you need forgiveness directly corresponds to how much you feel God's love for you. Right? The gospel becomes most precious to those who sin the most. Now, another thing to understand about the story, Jesus is absolutely not saying the reason why you don't understand the love of God is because you need to sin more. You know, He's not looking at the Pharisee being like, dude, you know what? She's just blown it more than you. You know, that's why she's loved more. You know, you go out, you get a drug addiction, I'll love you just the same. You know, that's certainly not what He's saying. He's saying you both are sinners, but she what? Realizes it. You don't. You're wrapped up in your self-righteousness and your legalism. But you're not doing that stuff for me. You're doing that stuff for you. It's the same thing, man. Because we don't recognize it. We don't appreciate it. So God blesses Isaac in spite of all of his mess. You know, and He gives him a well. And there's this really interesting story. But anyway, chapter 27 is a story that most of you know. Okay, basically what happens is Isaac's getting old. He's getting some cataracts in his eyes. It doesn't say that, but you know, you can kind of see in the fill in the blanks. He's losing his eyesight. And he looks at his son, Esau, and he's like, my boy, you know, my hairy guy, you know, go out, give me some food, you know, because I'm hungry. You know, I like your food. I dig it. You know, make me something awesome, and I'm going to bless you. I'm going to give you the blessing. And so Esau goes out. Now, once again, who did God say is going to get the blessing? Jacob. Doesn't matter what Isaac says. Jacob's getting the blessing. But Rebekah hears this, and she's like, oh my gosh, you know, I need to help God out, you know, because my husband's going to give him the blessing, and if I don't do something, God's going to fail, you know. And so she's freaking out, and she goes up for her son, and she's like, hey, man, here's what you're going to do. I'm going to kill a couple cows. I'm going to kill a couple goats. I'm going to make your dad some, you know, some awesome food. You give it to him. I'm going to put, this is funny. I'm going to put the hair of the animal on you so you feel like your brother. So this dude must have been pretty hairy, you know. He's like, I'm going to put this hair on you so you feel hairy like him. You put his shirt on. You go in there. You give him the food. He's not going to know the difference, right? He's going to bless you. And Jacob's like, dude, but, you know, my dad, you know, what if he knows it's me and then I get a cursing instead of a blessing? She's like, let the cursing be on me. Now, here's what you see, right? What is Rebecca's view of her husband at this moment? She's like, man, I just respect my husband. You know, he's awesome. You know, he does the right thing. I trust him. No, she has such a low view of him that she's willing to trick a blind man into giving the blessing to the other kid. Right? There's no dialogue. There's no communication. There's no Rebecca pulling Isaac aside and be like, hey, man, like, remember when God said that Jacob's getting this? You know, she doesn't do that. She has said, I got to trick him. Yeah, it's the only way it's going to happen. I got to trick him. And Jacob, even, he's being dragged along, and he's like, yeah, I guess we got to trick my dad. You know, I guess what's going to happen? Do you see how the family's, like, falling apart because of this? Because of this favoritism? And it happens in all families all over the world, right? Favoritism between siblings, how it creates rivalries, how it creates bitterness between parents and arguments and all this stuff. It's happening in this family, too. So he goes, he does it. And Isaac is tricked, right? He comes in. Jacob comes in. He does his best Esau voice. He's like, hey, Dad, you know, just got your food. And Isaac's like, sweet. You know, he grabs it, eats it. He's like, this is awesome. Blesses him. Esau comes like an hour later. And he's like, yo, dude, I got you this food. And Isaac's like, oh, my gosh. You know, I just gave a bless. Who did I bless? And Esau starts crying. He's like, dude, you gave it to Jacob. This guy, is he not rightly called heel catcher? He's taken my blessing twice, took my birthright. Now he took my blessing. This dude's a jerk. And Isaac, he realizes, right? He starts shaking because he realizes something. He can't bless Esau the way he wanted because who already determined it? God. He's convicted immediately. Because the question is, like, why couldn't he just be like, well, I was tricked. I take it back, you know? But he doesn't do that. Because he understands something. God already determined it. I can't go against God. God is the one who has the power to bless. So he gives Esau this blessing. He says, dude, verse 39. Behold, your dwelling shall be in the fattest of the earth and of the dew of the heaven above. By your sword you shall live and you shall serve your brother. And it shall come to pass, when you become restless, you shall break his yoke from your neck. Now, whether that's prophetic or not, probably not, because this never happens, right? It never really happens. You can kind of make the argument that it happens later on to Esau's descendants, but you get a little bit there that Isaac was a little bit peeved at what happened. And so he says this to Esau. He's like, dude, you're gonna get over on your brother one day. That's what he tells him. Esau's next words are pretty telling. He says, so Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing which his father blessed him. Esau said in his heart, the days of the mourning of my father are at hand. Then I will kill my brother. So he's waiting out the old man. He's like, dude, when Isaac dies, I'm going to freaking kill that runt. You know, I'm going to stab him. And Rebecca puts it this way. She says to him, this is verse 42. And the words of Esau, her older son, were told to Rebecca. And so she sent and called Jacob, her younger son, and said to him, surely your brother Esau comforts himself concerning intending to kill you. So she's like, he's just like, he, every single time he feels like a little angry, he's like, but I'm going to kill him, you know, and that's how he comforts himself. But just wait, man, it's going to come around, man. And I'm going to get up on this kid, dude. I'm going to break the yoke and it's going to be awesome. You know, and he's all excited. That's how he's comforting himself. And here we see why people stay bitter. Bitterness is a fantastic tool. Remember what I said? Sin is always easier. Bitterness is amazing. Dude, you know, people say, dude, bitterness is the worst ever. It's like a poison and yeah, whatever. Bitterness is incredible. Because you know what bitterness allows you to do? It allows you to take all the guilt over the stuff that you've done and put it on someone else. So you look at your life, and instead of being like, you know what, I've made some mistakes. You know, Esau could have looked at his life and be like, you know what, Dad? I know that Jacob stole the birthright from me, but at the end of the day, God's the one who said it, first off. And secondly, I've been really selfish. Man, I haven't even wanted it. I traded it for a freaking bowl of soup. Obviously, I'm a pretty impulsive dude. You know, obviously, I got some issues in my heart. Maybe it's better that Jacob's going to take the birthright and take care of the family. He doesn't think that way. Instead, he says, it's all my brother's fault. It's all my brother's fault. It's all him. You know, that's why my life is the way it is, right? People do it every day. instead of just owning up and being like, hey, you know what, I made some mistakes in my life, maybe that's why this stuff's going on, they instead go, my parents, man, look at what they did in my life, dude, my guidance counselor in middle school, you know, he said this to me, and I never got over it, or man, my high school girlfriend, you know, she burned me, and so because of that, I'm a wreck, and people will blame. Why? That's bitterness. It's the cure of bitterness, man. It allows you to ignore all the wrong stuff you've done and just put it on somebody else. It's a fantastic tool. It does eat your soul away, though. You know, like I said, it's easy short term, but it's horrible long term. Forgiveness is a terrible burden. It is not easy to forgive. It is not an easy thing to forgive somebody. Forgiving someone is looking at them and understanding that they have wronged me in severe ways and saying, yet I will not hold it against them because God is enabling me to forgive. I will give judgment to God and I will forgive them. That is one of the hardest, most difficult things any of us will ever do. Primarily what we end up doing, we call it forgiveness, is we just bury feelings. You know, we're angry at someone, or like, you know what, that's wrong, I'm just not going to feel that way. Well, you could say that all you want, but that anger and bitterness is still in you, right? That's not forgiveness, right? Forgiveness is something that you need to go through with God, and it's really tough. There are a lot of people in my life that I have been trying to forgive for years, and I still haven't forgiven them. Every now and then I think I've forgiven them, and then I like will find out that like, oh, I'm going to go see them tomorrow, and I'm just like, ugh. and I feel this like rock sink in my heart, and I just remember all the stuff they did to me, and I'm like, okay, you know, and I got to go back to God and be like, okay, I thought I'd let this go, but clearly I haven't. Can you help me? You know, can you help me? You judge them, help me forgive, help me love, you know, and I'll bring it to them. It is so hard to forgive someone. It is really, really difficult to forgive someone, but man, I got to tell you, bitterness is a far greater burden to bear. Number one, bitterness will get you to the place where you will never deal with any of the stuff that's wrong with you. You will always just blame other people. And so everything that's wrong with you will continue to be wrong with you. You'll never get to the bottom of it. You'll never figure it out. You'll continue to be the same rotten person that you are right now, and you'll actually get worse and worse as time goes on. That's first off. Secondly, bitterness consumes your thoughts. It really is like a poison. With bitterness, it's like, it's not enough that I'm just like, dude, this dude did me wrong, and so I'm angry at them. That's not enough. You got to assassinate that guy's entire character. So when someone comes up to you and talk to you about, hey, you know, I heard you had a little problem with Jerry, I'm like, dude, it's not just that, man. Jerry's whole life is a mess. You know, like he's messed up every day of his life, dude. He's a jerk and a deceiver, and I got to make things up, and I got to fabricate this villainous persona for him. Every good thing that he does, I have to reinterpret, be like, yeah, I know that he's, you know, going overseas to help the homeless or whatever, but that's just because he's a jerk, you know. That's probably because he's like, you know, going to buy drugs over there or something, because he's a jerk. You know, like I have to reinterpret everything he's doing, and I got to let that bitterness seep deeper and deeper into my soul until it rots me from the inside out. Yeah, forgiveness is tough, but it sure beats the alternative. That's the thing that we need to learn. That's what Esau teaches us over and over again. So basically, what Rebecca does is she goes to her husband, she goes, let Jacob get out of here, you know, because Esau, at this point, he's a polygamist. He's got two wives, and he got two wives from the Canaanites who were not the best of people. And she's like, dude, his wives suck. I hate them. I hate my daughters-in-law. If Jacob marries one of them, I'm going to freaking die. You know, like, dude, no way I could put up with Jacob having one of these girls. Tell him to go to my family, right? Go back to Haran, go back to that area, marry one of them, all right, because I can't put up with this anymore. And Isaac says, very well, you know, let him do that. So Jacob runs, and this is the best part, right? Jacob runs. He ends up in the middle of nowhere. He's lost everything. All he had was his mom. He doesn't have that anymore. His brother wants to kill him. His dad's pissed at him because he deceived him. He's got nothing. He's completely empty. And this is where God meets him. Verse 10. Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran. So he came to a certain place and stayed there all night because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of that place and put it at his head. And he lay down in that place to sleep. Then he dreamed, and behold, a ladder was set up on the earth, and its top reached to heaven. And there the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and your descendants. Also your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and the east, to the north and the south. And in you and in your seed, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Behold, I am with you and shall keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you. And this is really cool. I don't have time to go into this, but in the New Testament, Jesus, when he's talking to this guy, he says, I tell you, you will see angels ascending and descending on the Son of Man. And he's referencing this story. You guys get that? He's referencing this story. Jacob sees a ladder going from heaven to earth. And when Jesus is saying, he's saying, dude, I'm the ladder. I am the bridge between heaven and earth. I am the thing that makes travel between heaven and earth possible because I'm going to die for sinful man and I'm going to bring them to my Father in his place. So Jacob literally sees Jesus in this dream. He literally sees him. And God comes to him and says, dude, I am going to bless you. You're a mess, you're a wreck, but you don't need your dad, you don't need your mom, you don't need your brother, you need me. You need me, that's what you need. That's what's empty in your heart. You need me. And Jacob gets it for like a split second, which is what we all do. He gets it for like a split second. God's all I need, I got this. But then the second later, he says, if God does this for me, I'll serve him. So instead of just saying like, dude, I know God loves me and cares for me, so I'm going to serve him no matter what, he says, if God, you know, puts up his end of the deal, I'll put up my end of the deal. We got a bargain, right? And that's the way he's viewing God. Jacob's journey is going to take a lot longer than this. Hopefully next week we'll get to the end of his journey so I could go over it to you guys of how he finally comes to the conclusion that God is all he needs. But here's what I'll tell you. In all of our lives, we all have severe amounts of stubbornness, and we all have things in our heart that we think, if we had this, we would be complete. In Jacob's mind, he thinks, dude, if I had a father who loved me, I'd be complete. Later on, he's going to turn to women. He's going to be like, if I had a woman who loved me, I'd be complete. Then he's going to turn to money. If I had money, I'd be complete. And he keeps turning and turning and turning, and God finally brings him to the end of all of it before Jacob finally goes to his knees and said, all I need is you. Every one of us in our lives, we have stuff that we think will make us complete. And God can't tell us that's not going to work. He does tell us, but in our hearts, we don't believe him. So what God will do is he will judge these things in your life, and it's going to feel like hell. But he's doing it to show you something. All you have, all you need is God. He's going to be everything for you. And we need to learn this. And the gospel teaches us that he really is what we need. Right? Jesus, when he was about to die, he passed out communion, what we call communion. And he took the bread and he broke it and he says, this is my bread. It's broken for you. Man, nobody loves me like that. I mean, Isaac could think of it in his head. I mean, Jacob could think of his head. All of us can think of our head and our hearts. No one's loved me like that. That even though I'm a total jerk, even though I mess up, God would love me enough to break himself for me, to die for me? That's intense. And then he says, he pours out the wine, he says, this is my blood, dude, the new covenant, poured out for you. Jesus says, dude, we're going to make a covenant. I'm going to be one with you. I'm not going to leave you. I'm not going to abandon you. I'm not going to forsake you. In spite of all your flaws, I'm going to be with you. It says in 2 Timothy, though we are faithless, he remains faithful. See, it's that love that we actually need. That's what's going to get us home. You know, so the more we learn to accept that, the more we learn to embrace that, the more complete we're going to be as people. And then we could take these relationships that God's given us, and this is what Jacob learns. He takes the relationships that God gives him, and instead of making those relationships his salvation, he is then able to finally love. He's finally able to just pour himself out and to serve those people instead of always looking what I can get from these relationships. And that's something, like I said, that we all need to learn in our lives. But anyway, let's pray. Dear God, I want to thank you so much for these stories, and I pray that we would learn just what you've done for us within them, God, that we would learn to love you more, we would learn to trust you more, that we would really see genuinely that you are all we need. God, please take all these things that we look to for our comfort and for our salvation and bring them to nothing, Lord, that so we might learn that you are all we have, God, and your love is all that we desire. In your name, amen.